I'm Marty Mazzacoane. Welcome to Radio Times. It's hard to find the appropriate words to describe what happened last week. First, the shooting of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, by the police outside a convenience store where he had been selling CDs. That was followed by a police officer shooting Philando Castile in a car in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. The incident was captured by Diamond Reynolds, the driver of the car, describing in vivid and chilling detail what happened. Then on Thursday night in Dallas, Texas, Micah Johnson opened fire on police and transit officers during a peaceful demonstration, killing five, wounding nine, including two civilians. Johnson reportedly told police he wanted to kill white police officers in retaliation for punishing people of color. He was killed by a robot armed with an explosive device. President Obama is speaking at a memorial service in Dallas tomorrow. We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Time to talk about a whole host of things, including police-community relations, race, violence, guns, and let me introduce them to you. Joining us by telephone is David Harris. He's a distinguished faculty scholar and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. He specializes in policing issues, also host of the Criminal Injustice podcast produced by WESA Public Radio in Pittsburgh. And David Harris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you again, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Donald Tibbs. He's an associate professor of law at the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He teaches criminal law and criminal procedure, specializes in the area of African-American legal history, crime and punishment, and race in the law. And Donald Tibbs, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
I have to share with our listeners and also with you, David, that Don and I began by talking about what are we going to talk about today on the show,
right?
Because of the horror, frankly, of what happened last week. And I was thinking about this definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And I wonder, Donald Tibbs, is this a turning point or can this be a turning point for our country?
I think so. I mean, you know, we want to try to take from these moments of immense sadness, and to be as introspective as we possibly can. And also at the same time, try to figure out what are the possible solutions to the events that gave rise to all of the violence that occurred this past weekend. It is truly sad and really overwhelming to see so much death and destruction occurring in the streets, no matter who the victims are, no matter who the protagonists are. And I think that if we don't get on the same page as a nation and stop the sort of racial vitriol in terms of our conversations and stop the partisanship that occurs over things related to gun violence and race and policing and how to manage protest and what to do with anger, with extreme amounts of anger that are deeply buried and repressed within, we won't be able to move forward as a nation. So I hope that that is something that we can strive to, and that these conversations will continue to occur. But we want them to occur with some action, with some real progress.
David Harris, let me quote something that the Attorney General Loretta Lynch said. She said, "Let's not allow the events of this week to precipitate a new normal in our country." Sort of saying what Donald Tibbs just said: turn to each other, not against each other. Can this be a turning point?
I think so, Marty. I hope so, certainly. I can't stress strongly enough how much I agree with Dr. Tibbs' statement, because if we do not take this and seize the moment as a turning point, we'll be in for more of the same. And nobody wants that. It's in nobody's interest to have further deaths, further anger, deeper anger, to have any of this become a discussion that is far, far more heat than light. We need to turn to each other, as was just said, and have honest and strong conversation with each other. That's difficult to do under any circumstances. It's more difficult, again, when people are so angry and so hurt on both sides. But we have to recognize that we have to find ways to move forward. That requires finding where we do have common ground. That's in short supply now. Very few people seem to be looking for it. But I would say that, you know, everybody wants to live in a safe place. Everybody wants to have a good place to live and a place where they can thrive and work and live. And there's no way to create that except if police and communities can be on the same page and find ways to work together. Most of the people on every side of this want nothing more than that. That will require real examination of where we are, what has happened, and how we can get past it to find our way to those common goals.
Donald Tibbs, it sounds like what both you and David Harris are saying, and I think the Attorney General and others, which is having some sense of empathy, the ability to look at the world from someone else's perspective. And I think that's very hard to do, especially especially hard to do in these very critical situations when people feel so angry and so hurt and so confused.
Right. And certainly when there is a divide between the two sides, right? When there's such a clear divide between the police force and the African-American community, I think Professor Harris is right, is that if we don't bridge that gap and figure out ways in which we can make community policing work better, that divide will continue to grow. And whenever there is a divide and there is no common ground, what really happens is when you are under the spotlight, you tend to retreat to your side because that is a place that is safe for you. And so you will have, in the moments in which there are shooting deaths of unarmed black men by the police, their response will be to sort of move into a space to protect the name of policing, right? The culture of policing. Certainly when there's violence on the side of African Americans, there will be a retreat to say that, you know, there's a reason as to why we're doing this. There's an act and a premise behind why we're taking this particular stance. In between that is a massive gap. Right. And that massive gap, I think, is moving away from what's really important, which is humanity, right? Love, patience, kindness, respect, all of the things that actually were a premise and built as far as the civil rights movement is concerned. And we had some of the same types of violence during that particular time between police officers and between African Americans, more specifically between African American protesters. But there was never a loss in terms of love and respect and human kindness that the communities were trying to work towards. And so that is, I think, something that we have to get back to, which is trying to build that, bridge that gap in between.
Let me play a clip. This is President Obama. He was actually in Europe over the weekend. He was in Poland. This is the president speaking last Thursday about police-involved shootings.
African Americans are 30% more likely than whites to be pulled over. After being pulled over, African Americans and Hispanics are 3 times more likely to be searched. Last year, African Americans were shot by police at more than twice the rate of whites. African Americans are arrested at twice the rate of whites. African American defendants are 75% more likely to be charged with offenses carrying mandatory minimums. They receive sentences that are almost 10% longer than comparable whites arrested for the same crime. So that if you add it all up, the African American and Hispanic population, who make up only 30% of the general population, make up more than half of the incarcerated population. Now, these are facts. And when incidents like this occur, there's a big chunk of our fellow citizenry that feels as if, because of the color of their skin, they are not being treated the same. And that hurts. And that should trouble all of us.
To you, David Harris, is that implicit bias, explicit bias? Is that sort of not just the history of America, but is that the history of America?
Well, it is. It contains, of course, lessons about bias, whether conscious or unconscious, implicit bias. But more broadly, it is the policing and the law enforcement and the justice system that we as a country have built over the last 3 decades. It is not something that's happened by accident. The broader public said, let's have a war on crime. Let's have a war on drugs. And that's what we're seeing as a result. You have probably talked to your listeners. I know we've discussed before the president's task force on 21st century policing. Right. Recommendation number one was to move from the warrior mentality to the guardian mentality. In other words, let's not have wars in our communities, because in wars there are casualties, there is collateral damage, and the types of things that the president was talking about are just symptoms of that type of policing that we have encouraged and wanted. Let's make it clear we are all complicit in the way things are now, and from which we must turn if we're going to have a better, fairer system. If we don't do that, shame on us. People say you get the policing you ask for, and this is what we have asked for, and now it is time, well past time, to turn away from it and say we want a system that is fair and that treats people equally, and that responds to people when they need help, but does not declare war on whole areas of cities or communities as a way to fight crime. We know there are better ways. We know that that community policing gets results and does so without this kind of damage to communities. That's where we need to turn now. And when you talked about it being a turning point, one hopes that this will be the reignition of interest in all of those recommendations and other ways of doing things.
About a minute before our first break here, to Donald Timms, then picking up on what David Harris just said. So what is this fairer, better community policing? I mean, this is an issue that's been around, or policies that have been around for decades now. I don't know if it's difficult to implement, or it works in under certain circumstances and not under others.
I mean, there's a lot of things I think that we could look at in terms of policing paradigms that we should be calling into question in our modern era. Some of them are directly connected to constitutional rights like stop and frisk. You know, President Obama gave a really wonderful rendering of statistics. You know, here's another set of statistics that that came out from a case in New York City called Floyd, where the city was questioning, sort of being questioned about its stop and frisk policies, where, you know, between 2008 and 2012, they engaged in 4.4 million stops. Of those 4.4 million stops, 2.3 million of them resulted in frisk. Of those 2.3 million frisk, only 38,000 of them actually turned up weapons. That is a 98.5% failure rate for stop and frisk. And that is systematically happening to African-American men, black and brown men in New York City. So this sense of what we are experiencing in terms of policing is something that we have to start addressing in terms of the culture of policing.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Donald Timms. Also with us, David Harris. It's the aftermath, of course, of the shootings last week in Dallas and Baton Rouge and outside St. Paul, Minnesota, trying to make sense of what happened, the way forward. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with Donald Timms, Associate Professor of Law at the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law here in Philadelphia, and with David Harris, Distinguished Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh, talking about the shootings of last week, trying to make sense of what happened, if that's even possible, and figuring out the ways forward. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. It was really hard, but I watched over the weekend the video, if I can call it that way, taken by Diamond Reynolds. She's in the driver's seat as Philando Castile, her boyfriend, as I understand it, was shot by a police officer. We literally watched this man die. She sort of narrates it's almost, and I'm looking at you, Donald, it's almost like a play-by-play about what's happening, calling very respectfully to the police officer, calling sir. Mm-hmm. You see him in the window. He's got a gun in his hand. There's also a four-year-old in the back of the car. Mm-hmm. What do you see, or what? First of all, I think everyone should look at it, because it's. Right. I think there's some very important things that happened there. What What should we take away from that?
I think you're right. Everyone should look at it, but they should be cautioned that it's very hard to watch.
Extremely.
And very deeply saddening. As a matter of fact, I had to stop the video a couple of times because I couldn't stop crying from being emotionally overwhelmed by this particular moment. What you're watching is literally someone dying on camera in real time, and the sort of narrative that's coming out of that is the extreme bravery related to Diamond Reynolds to take an opportunity in this moment to capture it, to use social media to capture this and stream it live so that there would be no question about what happened and who it happened to and how it happened, and to hear her talking to this police officer very respectfully and reminding him of what he actually asked for, that this is a routine traffic stop that is over a broken taillight, allegedly over a broken taillight, and the officer is informed that there is a lawfully possessed and owned and licensed weapon in the vehicle. And that, if that's not what you're supposed to do to prevent yourself from having an escalating moment where you are getting shot and killed by a police officer, then I don't really know what is. Something that's really stark to watch in the video is to see Mr. Castile not only bleeding but still strapped in and his seatbelt, right? So where is and the officer is still at a very heightened, escalated moment where he's screaming about, I told him to get me this weapon. I told him, she said no. Diamond said no, you asked for his identification. So there's this moment where you have to question and ask yourself, like, what is the heightened level of escalation that is occurring between police officers and African-American motorists? And I don't think anyone, any of your listeners, whether they're white or black, would think that they were going to get in their car and during a routine traffic stop be shot and killed by a police officer and never have exited a vehicle or even unbuckled the seatbelt. So it's very difficult to watch. I think, you know, also a video has emerged of Diamond talking about how she was treated in the aftermath of this moment. And that's extremely important to watch as well, because she was detained by the police. She was taken to a police station. She was questioned for hours. All of those things sound like they should occur on the back end of being arrested and read your constitutional rights under the Fifth Amendment. And so there's questions and concerns about why exactly is she being detained? And what happens to this child, this 4-year-old child, in a moment in which the mother, who has just watched her fiance be shot and killed by a police officer, to have to be separated from the mother while Diamond is being questioned. And her narrative and what she told was a story of how they were trying to question her to make sure that there was a way to sort of blame Philando for this moment. And she just refused to accept that narrative.
David, going back to you, then how should a traffic stop like that, even if it's for a broken taillight, how should that proceed?
Well, number one, we have to ask ourselves, why are we stopping lots of people? And as President Obama said, many more African-American people for things like broken taillights. Why are we directing our law enforcement resources at things like that? These are all choices that a police agency makes when it deploys its officers, trains them, and tells them what to do. So it's not an accident that this kind of thing, that this kind of stop happens. When a traffic stop happens, police are often trained that these kind of situations are life-threatening, that many police officers get shot in situations like that. So most police officers approach this very routine thing with a heightened state of alert. Then Mr. Castile has a permit for a weapon, and he informs the officer, according to Diamond Reynolds, he informs the officer that he has a permit and the weapon is present. Now, what else you could possibly do to have a safe and secure traffic stop, I don't know. And yet, in a split second, that man is shot and he's dead moments later. So while it's important to understand that we don't have video of the shooting itself, So we don't know what happened in those terrible seconds.
That's right.
There's a lot of explaining to do about how something could go so terribly wrong. One thing you can't say here is that this turned out in some way according to protocol. You know, if somebody comes out and says that, I would be really, really surprised. I think a grand mistake was made here for a whole host of reasons, whether it's implicit bias or increased fear or whatever, because this man left his home in a car with a broken taillight lens. And that shouldn't end up with somebody dead. And I don't think most people in our society would have anything like that to fear leaving their homes. And yet this kind of thing happens. So you got to ask yourself first and foremost, why are our police departments making traffic stops for things like that that can turn into these sorts of disasters? Is that the way we want to allocate our law enforcement resources?
Let me play another clip, and this is the Dallas Police Chief David Brown. He was on Jake Tapper's show on CNN yesterday talking about what happened in his city.
We're sworn to protect you and your right to protest, and we'll give our lives for it. And it's sort of like being in a relationship where you love that person, but that person can't express or show you love back. I don't know if you've been in a relationship like that before, Jake, but that's a tough relationship to be in, where we show our love because there's no greater love than to give your life for someone. And that's what we're continuing to be willing to do. And we just need to hear from the protesters back to us. We appreciate the work you do for us in our right to protest. That should be fairly easy.
Why is that not easy? Or what do you think? What do you make, Donald Tibbs, of what Chief Brown just said?
I think he's right. I mean, I think it should be fairly easy to say thank you for your service. But I think Chief Brown has to recognize that many of the people that are actually protesting against the violence and the shooting deaths of Alton Sterling and the shooting deaths of Philando Castile have also probably been victims of police violence themselves, right? That if you look at the crowds, you know, the crowds of young black men, you just heard Obama talk about the way in which the criminal justice system and police stops occur against young black men. And so those same young men who are in the street protesting have also been victims, and they should see the protests as their sort of victim impact statement, that they are actually speaking out not against the police themselves. No one dislikes the police, and no one dislikes individual police officers unless those individual police officers are wreaking havoc in the black community. But I do think that what people dislike is the policing culture and the lack of accountability that it seems that the police face in the moments in which the average citizen would not be given the same sort of pass. So this comes out from and springs forward from a string of shooting incidents that date back to Trayvon Martin, in which no one is and killing deaths of unarmed black men in which no one is held accountable. And then when we're talking about police officers, we're talking about even failed indictments in the moments in which those indictments should be relatively easy to secure. So this is build up, right? And so it's hard when you feel like the ones that you want to protect you are not there to protect and serve you. A great example in this is the police officers, they allowed Philando Castile to bleed out. Mm. No one tried to help him. Mm. No one tried to help him. So how is it in that moment when you can have a shooting victim that you don't even try to do anything to save their life, but you run and sort of gather around a police officer who pulled the trigger, who's not in danger anymore, clearly, and tell him everything's going to be okay? It's that kind of disconnect between protect and serve that I think the protesters are having with what Chief Brown actually wants to occur.
David Harris, let me go back to you and just put something else on the table, because I was reading that in Dallas last week at this nonviolent protests, there were something like 20 or maybe 30 marchers, I'm looking at the New York Times here, showed up with AR-15s and other types of military-style rifles, wore them openly. There are more states with open carry laws where people can legally walk around and be armed and be visibly armed. How does that change policing, do you think, David?
Well, it changes it in an important way, and the presence of weapons, as we can see, does not necessarily make things safer. I mean, Philando Castile, he was armed. He had a permit. That didn't go so well, to put a very blunt point on it. And we always hear from certain people who support gun rights that, you know, if you had good guys with weapons, they can take out the bad guys. Well, that didn't work so well in Dallas on Thursday night. And I think it's tremendously complicating for police officers and dangerous to have to sort out what goes on when you have hundreds of thousands of citizens who have permits and who have legal guns, as well as all the illegal guns that are out there on the street in the hands of criminals. So that having lots of guns present does not make things easier. In fact, it makes it more difficult. And I think that this situation in suburban Minneapolis and then again in Texas, I think, you know, kind of drive that point home. I mean, there's probably no other state that has a bigger, wider gun culture than Texas. And yet, look at the horrible thing that happened down there. I would not say that having wide possession of guns or wide use of gun permits makes things safer for police at all.
Donald, do you think there's a stereotype with a, you know, a black man with a gun? In the case of Philando Castile, he had a permit, so he could legally carry this gun. But do you think there's a stereotype about, if you see a black man with a gun, then he's up to no good?
Yes, the stereotype of black male violence in this country is entirely overblown and actually overwhelming. And I would, you know, I would put an end cap on asking a really important question, which is, where's the NRA? Where's the NRA right now? Where is the NRA in terms of making a statement? Because one would think that Philando Castile is the quintessential case for them. This is the type of citizen that they stand behind. Someone who owns a gun, who carries it, who has it licensed. It's a permit. He has his Second Amendment constitutional right. And there seems to be just a complete silence from this national lobbying gun organization that wants to stand up for the rights of citizens to lawfully own and possess firearms. They should be speaking out right now. Their silence, their noticeable silence, raises some real flags in terms of thinking about how people think or relate the Second Amendment and race together, right? Is it their silence is saying that we have a Second Amendment right unless you're black, right? Mm-hmm. Black people don't have a right to carry a gun, and that may be because there is a relationship to gun violence and race and African-American males, but that's not what our Constitution says, right? It doesn't have any limiting effects in terms of the Second Amendment. So one has to ask those types of questions and really sort of call out those organizations to make the stands for African-American gun ownership in the same way they would if Philando Castile was a white male.
Interesting. And I thought it was also interesting, the governor of Minnesota, this was last week, said he didn't think this would have happened if Philando Castile had been white. I thought that was just an interesting thing for a governor to say.
Yeah, I mean, and I applaud the governor for being so brave to make such a bold statement. And that statement has been made over and over and over again by African-American and African-American men and African-American leadership. But it seems to get rebuked and it's called out as, well, you're playing the race card. And what we have from the governor and what we want is we definitely want more white Americans to stand up when they know that something is wrong and speak loud about it. it. And that's how we remove race from the conversation. It is not the things that are said that becomes problematic. It is the things that go unsaid, particularly from white Americans in relationship to moments in which they know that black suffering is occurring right in front of their face. If I was to put it in philosophical epistemological terms, I would call that bad faith. Just bad faith.
Well, and it seems, and I've been doing this show long enough, that, you know, these moments when we say, well, now this is the right moment to talk, to have a conversation about race. But it seems like we have a conversation about having a conversation about race, but we never actually have that conversation.
Right.
David, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, first, I'd like to say, yes, I agree with Dr. Tibb that the silence of the NRA is damning. And I'd like to the last comment, add Dr. King's comment, and I'm paraphrasing here, that and it may not even be Dr. King, please forgive me, but the worst thing that can happen is for good people to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we do need to have this kind of frank talk now. And, it makes some people uncomfortable, but when the governor of Minnesota says this probably wouldn't have happened if the people involved were white, all he's doing actually is reflecting on those same statistics that you had the tape of President Obama talking about just a little bit earlier. I've been working with those very phenomena and numbers and data for years. That stuff isn't new. And it is important that people come out and say, well, look, if this were a white person, statistically, we know it would be much less likely to happen, that they would get stopped, that they would get searched. That's not something that's in real dispute anymore. And people have to be willing to come out and say it. Is that going to make some people mad? Sure it will. But we need to have a conversation where if people get mad, that's okay. And people can talk to each other in a very frank way, because Dr. Tibbs is right. You have to speak up when you see injustice. If you're quiet, you're complacent. It isn't the same thing as doing the act, perhaps, of the unjust. But you have to speak up when these things happen. And this is the time for that.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's David Harris. Also with us, Donald Tibbs. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking about the last week of violent events in this country, shootings both in Dallas, or I should say in Dallas, Baton Rouge, and outside of St. Paul, Minnesota. And again, our guests are Donald Tibbs, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, and David Harris, Distinguished Faculty Scholar, Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh, also host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast, and that's produced by WESA Public Radio in Pittsburgh. 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to join the conversation. We got some emails as well, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get David from Flemington to join us on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I believe we're setting ourselves up for disappointment if we think there's anything that's going to generate an overall change in the interpersonal style of police. They don't become police to be social workers or clergy. And we've been through this scene before from the 1960s, and we're here again. So why would it change now? I don't want to be without hope, but why would it change now? Thank you.
You're welcome, David. It's a good question. In fact, let me put that to you, David Harris, because you have written a lot about community policing, what it is, how it works, how it can be foster better relationships between police and community.
Yeah, this is a good question, and I wouldn't want to be without hope either. The fact is that these things can change, the approach can change, and I say that because we have seen it happen in places like Los Angeles, which had a militaristic outlook with its police force culture for many, many years, and is now oriented towards its community in some very positive ways, like in Cincinnati, where they had very serious civil unrest in 2001 after many shootings of unarmed black men. What we have to do is reorient the culture within these departments. And what I can say for sure is it's not easy and it's not quick. But it can work. It has worked in other places. And if we insist on that kind of policing, if we hire new recruits with the idea that we don't want people to rappel down buildings as their first qualification, we want people who communicate. That is the type of police officer that we have, that we can have, and the type of police agency we can have if we insist that that's what we want and we hold behaviors that are outside of that, we hold them accountable. That takes real leadership. It takes dissatisfaction by some people, and some may leave the department. But a department can be changed if you pay attention to the culture and you influence the culture and you insist that that is how it's going to be, and you're patient enough. It isn't easy, but it can work. We have seen it.
It's hard to change culture, Donald, but it's not impossible. But, you know, every institution has its culture.
Right. I mean, the culture and cultural norms are present in every institution. There's not one institution that you can go into that doesn't have a sort of set of written rules and unwritten rules that must be followed in order to survive and be a part and be present in that culture. I think, you know, in terms of answering questions related to hope, as a black man, I have to have hope. I don't have any other choice. I need to have hope that we can change things. And I completely agree with the caller that this, you know, the incidents that we're seeing today are history repeating itself from the 1960s. We're starting to see, you know, history repeating itself from the civil rights movement and the black power movement. And one can ask questions about how can things still be so wrong 50, 60 years later, right? How can things still be so wrong? And but things have gotten better. And I have to believe
that
they
can. Both are true in a way.
Right, absolutely. And we need to have hope. Like, if I don't have hope as a black man, then I'm relatively doomed to drive my vehicle.
Because you're going to get stopped.
I'm going to get stopped.
Well, I don't know if you have sons or children or whatever, whether you've had that so-called talk or whether you were, as a young man, given the talk by your parents.
I was given the talk by my father. Right. Absolutely. I was given the talk by my father as a young African-American man right around the time that things weren't quite as bad then as they are today. So right around the time I started driving a vehicle, I was informed for the very first time that, listen, son, people will see you differently than you see yourself. And so you have to understand that the way that you present yourself in society is connected to reflections that may or may not be yours to uphold or to be a part of, but they will certainly be something that you will experience. And the reality is that there's a long-standing history of distrust between the black community and the police.
When David talks about, you know, more community policing, it's things like de-escalation, mm-hmm. figuring out about what bias is about and mm-hmm. how that can impact relationships, a citizen complaint process. I'm basically quoting you here, David, but looking at Donald, independent oversight, learning from mistakes, a review process. Do you think all that then can go into helping police, I guess, look at the community with less suspicion?
Yeah, I think so. But I think the police have to stop seeing it as us against them, right? This is, you know, having community oversight should be a part of community policing. There should be absolutely nothing wrong with that. Wanting your officers to respect the Constitution of the United States that they're swearing to defend and uphold should not be something that they push back against, right? If we remember the way the NYPD pushed back against the mayor there because he took away their ability to use stop and frisk as a policing paradigm, it's really interesting to sort of watch the people who swear to uphold this document and our rights being pushing back so hard when they think it's going to infringe on their ability to do a particular type of job. So I think that there is definitely something to be said about community policing. And we're going to have to get to a place where the police culture has to really start having some type of external oversight and review of these cases. Because what happens in these moments is that the police officers shoot, they're whisked away, and we don't hear anything else from them until there is a later pronouncement about what actually happened in the case. We don't get an opportunity to have any insight into that at all. And the next thing you know, it rolls forward, the narrative changes, and then the character assassination begins, right? The sort of documenting the ways in which these unarmed black men were troublesome in some particular way, that they're a bad person here, they're a bad person there. So that somehow that might justify the unlawful shooting that occurred in this particular moment. So then after the assassination character plays out and that narrative comes together, then we ultimately learn that here's a story that pops out. I think the Michael Brown case is a perfect example. I read the testimony, the grand jury testimony for Darren Wilson, and I cannot believe that. It does not make sense. I'm sorry. Young African-American men do not walk up to the car of police officers and just start punching them in the face. That just does not happen. So this narrative that comes out of that, I think, is something that we have to question. And that's what's once again creating the divide between the black community and police officers.
David, let me go back to you, and then we got a lot of people that want to join us as well. And certainly many of the protests have been peaceful, and most of the protesters are peaceful, but there are protesters who curse at police, get in their face, want to provoke some kind of confrontation or some kind of response, talk about, you know, revolution or sometimes even killing cops. How can cops deal with that? How can police officers deal with that?
Well, police officers have a difficult job in many ways, and this is one. They, you know, as we were hearing from the Dallas police chief a few minutes ago, they have the job of protecting the rights of protesters under the First Amendment, even when the protesting isn't friendly to them. They would like to have a little support and love in return. Who can blame them? But the fact is, police officers have to take abuse when it comes in a form that is not criminal. I mean, that is the law. So as long as protesters are not actually doing any criminal acts, they can give the finger, they can use curse words, they can say a lot of very provocative things, but that is all protected by the First Amendment. So that's something that most of us might not put up with, but sure, that's just part of the job for them, and they have to allow that to go on. That is part of the American tradition. Dissent is patriotic, even when it's unpleasant.
Let me get Ed from
Black.
Black. Let me get Ed from Willow Grove to join us. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. You know, I'm in full agreement with what your guests are saying. I'm a former Colorado State peace officer, and I want to say peace officer. That's your job. I remember trying to help an older African-American couple, and when they were broken down, they were scared to death of me. And I really feel escalation of force is out of hand, training's out of hand, and a lot. Most peace officers really care and try to do their job, but it's out of hand, and they're so right.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to add to that, Donald?
Yeah, I thank our caller for reminding us that this is about peace, right? Mm-hmm. That is a very important component of policing, that you are a peace officer. And bringing the peace and restoring the peace is important also to be peaceful in yourself, even while you are doing your own job. And I think Professor Harris is right about dissent. I mean, we just celebrated the 4th of July. You know, how do we get to the 4th of July? It began out of dissent. It was a protest against the British crown, against the state power that was actually using imperial actions against colonists. So this nation, our states, are founded on protests. And that protest was not peaceful. They were dumping tea into the water. That is a high act of tyranny against the government, right? That is tyranny. That is as unpatriotic as the government could have seen it at that time. But the people were speaking for themselves and saying, no, we will no longer stand up to you, basically the British crown policing us in this particular way.
Let me read a email, or maybe it's a tweet from Pastor Maya Avent of North Philadelphia. It seems that we keep talking like this treatment from some police officers of my community is new, when in fact what seems to be new is the presence of cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. Please address this. And it's, I mean, in certain ways, David, yes, there are more cameras that are being used by law enforcement, but also people are carrying cameras. We've got police departments that are also carrying cameras as well. And it seems that's one way that we know more about what's going on, because we can actually see it.
That's right. We don't have more police shootings of civilians or black men, as far as anybody can tell. Statistically, what we have is much greater awareness of these events because of the presence of civilian, basically cell phone video. And that makes this seem much more personal and vital to people, I think. And it has also made clear that this is not some set of isolated incidences in individual places. It is a national problem. Now, let's be clear that video, whether it comes on cell phones or police body cameras, does not solve every problem. It is an important advance. It's not a silver bullet. But what it does is it puts certain facts beyond controversy and exposes them more widely. So it has been a sea change in terms of the public attitude, because they can see it and certain things simply cannot be denied.
Let me get Gary from Malvern to join our conversation. Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm a 72-year-old Republican, and I guess I'm the only one who's optimistic about all this.
Interesting.
I've seen a lot, and the civil rights movement in the 60s, and I was an activist against the war in Vietnam. I think I know a lot about the suffragette movement, and I see us in sort of the same situation. I don't think change comes easily. But I do know one thing. I have something to be happy about, and I see it in the kids. I see them being colorblind. I see it on the baseball fields and how they interact with each other. Keep in mind, I was in D.C. when they still had signs on the bars of blacks entering from the back, and I've seen a lot of change. But until we get away from the fear of each other, we stop being afraid, and cops are afraid too. Unless we actually sit down and talk, and I hope we have a vehicle by which that happens, but really talk. Because I know that can change too, because
sure.
One of my best friends in the service, and I was a vet, was a black man. And he was my best buddy. And
I hear you, Gary, and I hear the emotion in your voice as well. We're kind of welling up here as I'm looking across at Donald Tibbs. And Donald, about a minute before we have to end our conversation, the president is going to be in Dallas tomorrow for a memorial service, or perhaps several. I'm not sure at this point, but what would you like him to say?
I think, the president has a really tough job of keeping a nation divided keeping a nation from being divided when he himself is an African-American man, someone who understands very clearly what this experience is like. But he's also our commander-in-chief. And not just – I think of him as the commander-in-chief, not just of our military, but also of our police forces. So he has to go and basically be two people at one time, right? He has to truly experience what Du Bois called double consciousness, right? Being one person on one side and another person on the other side. And that one person, unfortunately, is not treated and liked as well, right? But on the other side, speak for people that he wants to be treated and liked as well. So Chief Brown is absolutely correct. The president himself knows very well what it means to be someone who is in a love-hate relationship with the American public.
Well, I do wish we could go on, but I thank you both very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Donald Tibbs, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And David Harris, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure, Marty. Always good.
Always good as well. David Harris from the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Donald Tibbs from the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can probably carry on a conversation on our Facebook page. We posted some photos there as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We've got hour two. We'll be right back.